Patrick Henningsen and TNT.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to TNT Today's News Talk. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. We are live and direct for the next 2 hours. Thank you so much for joining us. We're going to have a couple of fantastic guests on. As you know, a lot has gone on over the weekend. We're going to be joined in the first hour, hopefully, by a journalist from Britain, Tony Gosling, to talk about the Iran-Israel crisis and all the different dimensions of it. Tony is a fantastic investigative journalist, and he's been very strong on the Middle East, on the issue of Iran, on the issue of Israel for many years now. We're looking forward to talking with Tony Gosling in the first hour. And then in the second hour, we're going to switch gears a little bit and pivot towards the end times eschatology, the religion, the cults, the ideologies that drive a lot of the geopolitics, especially when it comes to the Middle East, Israel, Christian Zionism in the United States. And one of the best people to talk about this is Jay Dyer. He's the author of Esoteric Hollywood 1 and 2. He's also got a fantastic podcast series. He has been doing teach-ins for years on these very subjects. We're very lucky to secure Jay Dyer in the second hour, especially at this crucial time, to talk about this issue. So I'm looking forward to speaking to Jay about that and other issues in the second hour. So that's going to be quite a lot in terms of analysis and getting to the nub of some of these issues from a couple of incredible experts. So I'm looking forward to that. In terms of the latest on this story, if you've been following this as closely as many of us have, you'll know that things are really on a knife edge right now. Over the weekend, just to recap, Iran launched a retaliatory attack inside Israel. We weren't sure if this was going to happen. As you know, we spoke about this on the weekend, and we weren't sure if it was actually going to happen or when it was going to happen and what shape it might take, but it actually did happen in the end. So we're talking right now about the possibility of Israel launching its own retaliation against the Islamic Republic of Iran, and Israel threatens to retaliate somehow significantly in the next 24 to 48 hours. We're also told that President Joe Biden had intervened with a phone call over the weekend to prevent Israel from striking back at Iran. Then we hear from the Israeli cabinet just this morning that they have approved a retaliatory strike against Iran. And Iran has announced, just to make things more interesting and more frightening, Iran said if Israel retaliates and any Iranian assets are hit, any persons, any assets, not only in Iran, but elsewhere, that they're going to strike back 10 times more than they did over the weekend. Now, this is significant, because over the weekend, they launched upwards of, by anyone's estimation, between 350 and 450 drones and missiles into Israel. Not all of them made it the distance. Many of them were shot down before they even got there. But a percentage did land, and they were pretty impactful in terms of the Israeli airbase in the Negev Desert towards the south, which houses a lot of sensitive aircraft and are used as sort of launching pads for Israeli strikes. So strategically, Israel's already been dealt a significant blow. Now multiply that times 10, and we're talking about hundreds of missiles potentially. So most of these were drones. Reports are that a lot of old drones were used, a lot of old missile tech. That's what was sent by the Iranians. And the thinking there is that Iran was basically probing the Israeli air defenses. So basically, we got an analysis on this. This is from Fatih Koran on X, formerly known as Twitter. I posted this at the top of my feed. At Stanford, I attended a masterclass, he said, on military strategy, led by a person with decades of experience, including serving at the highest levels in military and government. Presumably, this is in the United States. One lesson he taught that I always remember was he asked us, quote, say the U.S. decided to attack Iraq with a new stealth jet it hadn't used before that evaded all radars. The attack was a success. Was it strategic? Many in the class raised their hand and said, yes, it achieved its goal. But the professor said, it may not have been. Why? Because now that your adversaries know your capabilities, and it's a matter of time before they find ways around them. If this attack could be done with conventional weapons, it's better to keep your top weapons until you absolutely need them. Using them creates a disadvantage. Now, where does this come into play? Because of Iran's attack, the scale of the attack, the diversity of the locations it's targeted, the weapons it's used, forced Israel to uncover the majority of its anti-missile technology, and the U.S. positions in Jordan as well, I might add, that they have across the region. The Iranians did not use any weapons. Israel didn't know it had. It just used lots of them. But the Iranians likely now have almost a full map of what Israel's missile defense system looks like, as well as where in Jordan and the Gulf the U.S. has installations. It also knows how long it takes to prepare them, how Israel society responds, etc. This is a huge strategic cost to Israel, which Arab regimes now are being blasted by their peoples, particularly the Jordanian monarchy, for not doing anything to protect the Gazans, but then going all out to protect Israel. Talking about King Abdullah II in Jordan, he is really under the cosh at the moment. And right now, let's go back to Fadi. He basically continues here. So he says, crucially, Iran can now reverse engineer all of the intelligence gathered from this attack to make it much more deadly and more credible the next time, while the U.S. and Israel will have to redesign away from the current model, which has been compromised. Its success is stopping this choreographed attack is thus still very costly. Moreover, with the threat of the regional war that neither the U.S. nor the Arab regimes want and feel that's coming nearer, it's likely the pressure on Israel to back down will increase, making a ceasefire more feasible. So back to Gaza in the end. We'll go more on this analysis when we connect Tony Gosling in just a few moments. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. This is TNT Today's News Talk. We'll be right back.
TNT's Alex Zaharoff-Royd.
I saw the information that you shared about the app that endometriosis can take years to diagnose. But why is this, and how does the app help make this diagnosis much faster and more accurate?
The time frame from the first onset of symptoms until somebody actually realizes that there's a problem, that's remained fixed at 3 years. So all of our advances have been from when they first present to a GP until a diagnosis has been made. But those first 3 years have not been able to be shifted. And that's really where something like Charlie comes in. Because it's all about telling someone that what you're experiencing is actually quite abnormal.
Talking Tech with Alex Zaharoff-Royd on Today's News Talk, TNT. A better business tip from TNT Radio. The benefits of advertising on Today's News Talk, TNT Radio, should be clear to businesses of any shape or size. It can be accessed anywhere, anytime, by anybody, and is the perfect way to build brand awareness and stimulate digital activity. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live.
Listen up!
Listen, we gotta talk.
It's what we do best.
This is Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, folks, welcome back. Welcome back to the program. We're going to connect our guest in just a moment. Very lucky we've got Tony Gosling with us in just a few minutes. But just back to the Iran-Israel question. Suffice to say, all of this excitement over the weekend, all of the anxiety, the trepidation has taken the focus away from Gaza. For the people in Gaza, it's been one of the first nights, and just the last two nights, where there hasn't been bombing. But we're told the Israeli attack on the civilians in Gaza has resumed today. But they did have at least one or two nights, first time in the last 6 months, 7 months, where there wasn't airstrikes coming down on innocent civilians in Gaza. So at least a chance to catch their breath, but only briefly. But back to the analysis. Moreover, Okay, this is a continuation of the analysis from Fatih Koran. Moreover, the threat of a regional war that neither the United States nor Arab regimes want to happen is likely to press pressure on Israel to back down. That pressure will increase, making a ceasefire more feasible. Back to the initial issue, the ceasefire. Anyone assuming this is just theatrics is missing the context of how militaries assess strategy versus tactics. Theater is an important factor, but gathering intelligence of the enemy's posture is more valuable, especially if one believes they're in a long war of attrition. Netanyahu and the Israeli government prefer a quick, hot, and urgent war where they can pull in America. Very important point. The Iranians prefer a longer war of attrition that bleeds Israel of its deterrence capabilities and makes it an ally for Arabs and the U.S. That's too costly for either of those two parties to have. Lastly, if you're a person who hates war, if you want peace, the best and only way to get there in the region is to support the Palestinian struggle for freedom, justice, and dignity. There is no sustainable peace possible as long as Palestinians live under an oppressive system of apartheid. Fatih Koran. I've reposted that again on my ex Twitter account. So important points there. And if you think about it, if Iran does a counterstrike, if Israel goes through with their threat tonight or in the next 24 hours, that they're going to hit back at Iran, which we're told Joe Biden and the United States government has intervened to tell Israel, don't take a win. No one was killed in these Iranian strikes on Israel. There was some military damage, and maybe their pride was hurt in Israel, but nobody was killed. Unlike the Israeli attack, which did kill many people, and the many other attacks previously that killed many people, and the genocide, etc. There's a lot of dead bodies behind Israel. Iran, on the other hand, hasn't killed anybody. So suffice to say, the United States says, take a win, Tel Aviv. Your air defense was victorious. Your Iron Dome was glorious. Your David Sling, your Arrow 3, all of your various defense systems, along with the THAAD radar and missile systems that the United States has. It was a great victory. Just cash in your chips and you can fight another day, but not now. That's what Washington was telling the Israelis. So if Israel does hit back at Iran, then we got a slight problem because Iran says they're going to hit back 10 times as hard. 10 times as hard. So that means they're going to fire probably more advanced missiles at more specific military targets. And who knows, maybe even hypersonic missiles. So that's what Israel and the United States and their allies have to contend with if the ladder of escalation continues. If it stops here, there might be a chance for more constructive negotiated settlements, especially regarding this horrific situation in Gaza. Okay. So that may not happen. We might not get a chance for that to happen. We'll see what happens over the next 24 hours. Now, let's just get a retrospective and a review, a summary of events. And I want to get the reactions from a fantastic journalist based in Britain. He's also a great geopolitical analyst. He is a historian. He is an author. His name is Tony Gosling. He's joining us right now on the live link. Tony, how are you?
Hi, Patrick. Thank you very much for inviting me on. And you know, you're puffing me up to be something I aspire to. I'm not sure if I'm able to reach all those, but you're right. I mean, I have written I've written two books which I published during the lockdown. One is an anthology of secret governments since the English Civil War, right up to the assassination of Princess Diana and beyond, which is not my writing. It's an anthology of stuff I've picked up over the decades. And that's called The Siege of Heaven Reader. And then I've also done this book, which is the kind of UK version of Operation Paperclip, which is linking the Nazis to Winston Churchill and the British government in World War II, and showing the deals that were done at the end of the Second World War with the Brits, rather than, as most people know about Paperclip, but very few people realise that, you know, the very, very tight, close links there were between, in 1944 and 45, the end of World War II, between Churchill's private secretary and Hitler's private secretary, the deals being done for all that looted wealth of Europe.
Well, it's kind of relevant to what we're looking at right now in the Middle East, Tony. As you know, the formation of the State of Israel, the creation of the Zionist state, the role that was played by even Nazi Germany, as well as the British in the formation of Israel, all of these things have led us to the present day. And this is definitely in your wheelhouse, because I know you follow Israeli, Middle East, and Iranian politics very closely, as well as British and American foreign policy, Tony. So let me just backtrack a little bit. Let's go back about 72 hours, Tony. What were you thinking on Friday? Did you think that Iran, because it was the most extraordinary thing, Tony. They're saying Iran has announced they're going to strike. All the U.S. intelligence people were screaming, waving their hands, going hysterical. When that happens, Tony, all these alarm bells normally go off in the back of my mind saying something strange is going on. Are we going to get a false flag here? What's happening? What were you thinking at that point?
Well, my immediate thought, so it sounds like similar to yours, actually, Patrick, which is, why is this all being flagged up so long beforehand? Quite clearly, the Iranians have decided that they're doing this in a very sort of open, transparent, even though they're using diplomatic back channels, and flying these drones, slowly sort of coming in, announcing it all hours before the drones even reached Israel. This is quite clearly part of the tactic to prepare the world for something. You wouldn't normally expect that with a military strike by one country on another. Certainly the Israelis never flag anything up that they're doing beforehand. And so this was really extraordinary. And the fact that whatever strike it was moving in at, you know, subsonic speed, chugging along these old drones. Very peculiar. But actually, you can see why they've done it. And that is that they're trying to give the impression anyway of doing this in a sort of open manner. We're not trying to hide anything. The drones are coming, and we're hitting back in as open a way as they can. I think once they've decided to retaliate in some way, I think this is quite a mature way to do it. In fact, in the public eye rather than out of the public eye, everything the Israelis do seems to be in an underhand fashion, secret. They deny, for example, they've still not admitted, to my knowledge, that they were behind the attack on the consulate in Damascus, the Iranian consulate, because they neither confirm nor deny, because they know that this is going to be an awkward thing for them to justify on the world media stage. The Iranians have taken completely the opposite point of view, is they're trying to be open with the world about what they're doing. I think it's that simple.
And in international relations language, Tony, they call that the predictable behavior of a normative power, a normative world power. And UN Security Council members are expected to behave like this. They're saying to their adversaries, you violated international law, you've crossed this red line. Now we're going to do this, and it's going to be deliberate. It's going to be reciprocal. So this is a normative power. And Tony, throughout history, the international system tends to favor normative state actors. Israel, on the other hand, is not a normative state actor. They act almost with impunity as a rogue state, if you will, completely outside the bounds of pretty much every international norm you can possibly think of, especially at the last 6 months. I mean, look what's happened. So in this way, Tony, do you think this is a big moment for the Islamic Republic of Iran, where they're now stepping onto a sort of different platform now internationally?
Well, I think the Iranian Republic has for many years has wanted to strike back at Israel, but they just waited for the right opportunity. And by the Israelis opening up this new front by destroying the consulate in Damascus, their consulate, this has really given them a causus belli to do that. Let's just be clear about the history here, because the United States and the French and the Israelis have been involved in terrorist attacks on Iranian soil for many years now. I mean, it really has increased since 2010. We've had assassinations of these various nuclear scientists, politicians, and generals recently, obviously with Soleimani and these two generals in Damascus. So this has been going on and on and on. And I think what the Iranians are saying is that we need to send a very clear signal to the world and to particularly to the Israelis that this just is not allowed to carry on. It's a very peculiar and strange way to proceed if you're at war with a country to just do assassinations. I mean, what are they doing? They're assassinating people who Israelis have been assassinating people who are. There was a bomb attack on the entire Iranian cabinet. There's been two of those through history by the NATO powers, by the Western powers, and the Israelis, all involved in these things by joint work of intelligence services to carry out these attacks. And also, of course, on the Israelis have been attacking not necessarily Iranian, but certainly clerics. I always remember the killing of Sheikh Yassin many years ago. This guy was preaching for peace. He was very much, though, stalwart in saying that you have the right to self-defense. That's all he was saying. And because he was a powerful Islamic political leader in the Palestinian territories, he was assassinated too. So these assassinations, they are doable, in the world of hybrid warfare. But the thing is that they cannot carry on. They cannot continue. And they are. Should we say easy? I mean, they are much easier to do than to take on an entire nation. And what, of course, the idea is with these assassinations is to try to destabilize the leadership, it's personal attacks on the leadership. And that works if you've got a fragile leadership, like somewhere like Saudi Arabia, a few people running the country with very little democratic accountability. But it doesn't work, I don't think, in a place like Iran, which has and Russia as well, which has a much more spread leadership. So when these people are assassinated, there are others who will take their place. It doesn't really affect things that much, in my view. And we've also got to understand the history of the Israeli statements about their intentions towards the rest of the world and towards Iran. There was the famous statement by Moshe Dayan, who was the general in charge during the 1967 Six-Day War, and in the 1970s, the Yom Kippur War, the leader of the IDF in those days. He said, Israel must be like a mad dog, too dangerous to bother. And that seems to have been enshrined in Israeli foreign policy. So just don't even think about taking us on because something terrible is going to happen to you. The Israelis, by the way, the Zionists, in fact, in the 1940s invented the letter bomb. They invented the car bomb. They were making plans to assassinate Winston Churchill, MI5 files revealed a few years ago. They were making plans to assassinate Truman, President Truman in the United States, and also Ernest Bevin, who was the British Foreign Secretary after the Second World War in 1946. They were planning, an old colleague at the BBC of mine actually did a document program, a whole 30-minute documentary about the attempt to kill Ernest Bevin. And so these are the tactics that I'm afraid cowards use. They're not prepared to take on the system, but they think that they can make some sort of victory by taking out a few influential individuals. This, I'm afraid, does not endear them to the rest of the world. Even if they had a just cause of some sort, these are underhand tactics, the sort of things that we saw going on in the Second World War quite a lot. But there's another quote. This is by Martin van Creveld. I don't know if you've come across him. He's a Israeli historian at Hebrew University. He said, we have the capability in 2002. He says, we had the capability to take the world down with us. Now, this is the most irresponsible sort of comment you could imagine from a kind of nuclear armed doomsday cult. So that sort of thing. And he also said, I think, I'm not sure which date he said it, but then he was also, admitting to the possession of nuclear weapons by the Israelis. He also talked about the weapons that we've got, the nuclear weapons can be pointed in any direction. They could even hit Rome, he said. So this is a direct threat also to the European capitals, to the European powers. And that's what I mean about the mad dog too dangerous to bother. Even your allies are being threatened with nuclear strikes by the Israelis. And I think the whole world is getting tired of this. There's only a handful of people, I think, that really support them. They are, the likes of David Cameron, who was installed by Charles III as Foreign Secretary. on Remembrance Sunday last year, like a month after the October the 7th attacks, the Foreign Secretary and the Foreign Office weren't playing ball. And so this guy had to be brought out of his retirement, the man behind the war in Libya, the attacks on Libya. You've also got Rishi Sunak from Goldman Sachs, who basically will read out anything that he's put in front of him. And of course, you've got Joe Biden, who sort of wanders around the stage looking for the microphone. And you're lucky if you could get two sentences of sense out of the guy. And so these are the few people, plus obviously the deep state, the intelligence services, the financial institutions. Many of them are supportive of the Zionists too. But most of the people, I think, around are aware of just how dangerous the attack on Gaza and the genocide that's been taking place, 35,000 or so innocent people genocided by the Israelis has been. And so, you know, I've also, I'm in two minds about Friday night and Saturday morning, because I can see that the support for the Israelis has been crumbling in the West, Patrick. We've seen all sorts of diplomatic and political pressure being put onto the British government and the US government to rein back the Israelis. Although it's galling to see them get away with these crimes, particularly for the Arab countries and the Iranians surrounding Israel, you can see that the Israelis have been making so many terrible mistakes by this committing this genocide, telling so many lies. I'm, you know, sitting back and watching this, I'm tempted to just let them get on with making these mistakes, with telling these lies, and see their credibility crumble. Of course, they've got problems in Tel Aviv and in Jerusalem too, these mass demonstrations by Israeli citizens also calling for the end of the Netanyahu regime. And so in a way, the attack by Iran has maybe given them a little bit of a new lease of life, and they might feel that they can now hold their heads up high and say, oh dear, we've been attacked. But I think ultimately, when I saw this on Friday, I mean, you know what? I remember the first Gulf War. This is 1989, 1990. I had a similar sort of feeling. My God, are we going to wake up tomorrow in World War III? You know, this is when the Scud missiles were attacking from Iran into Israel, and we weren't sure if there was going to be some sort of nuclear response by the Israelis. You know, I was feeling in a similar way when the brinksmanship of the United States and Britain, the so-called coalition of the willing under Bush Senior, started attacking Iraq, because the Iraqis, of course, then started sending their missiles over to Israel, knowing that this was really a proxy war that the Americans were doing for the Israelis back then. So every time there's some sort of escalation over there, I think we need to sort of sit and scratch our heads and hold our breath a little bit, because we know they've got hundreds of nuclear weapons, the Israelis, and they are very unpredictable there, as we've seen in Gaza, an extremely dangerous lot. They are racists, they are maniacs, and they've got someone at the helm, Netanyahu, who is trying to keep this war going in order to try to dodge jail. He should be in jail. He's been prosecuted for fraud. And so he knows he's got to keep the war going to stay out of prison, Patrick.
Yeah, and maybe even stay out of The Hague for that matter. But just backtracking a little bit, you're talking about all these assassinations that Israel's been doing, and they've been kind of gnawing away at the edges of Iran's assets, their people, their positions in neighboring countries like Syria, for instance. And Iran's position has always been that of strategic patience. But that's all changed now. Now the bar has been reset in a way. Now it's active strategic measures, active deterrence. That's the new Iranian policy. They've announced that if Israel retaliates in Iran or hits any of their assets, and correct me if I'm wrong, Tony, they're saying any assets and any Iranian assets anywhere in the world, that they're going to hit back 10 times harder than they did over the weekend. That's a very different reality, isn't it, than the last 50 years. So in a way, things have reset. But when you listen to the Israelis and some people in America and Rishi Sunak and some of these hawks, David Cameron, for instance, Lord Cameron, pardon me, they're still living in the past, Tony. I don't think, do you think that they understand the new reality, that this is not the same Middle East that it was 20 years ago, 10 years ago?
Yes, I think they have to understand that. Look, I mean, the Israelis have the same policy. We will hit back 10 times harder. Look at the kill ratio between the IDF and the Gazan people. You know, we're talking about something like 100-1 kill ratio there. So the Israelis have the same, you know, we will escalate this quickly policy, and we will... and this is the same sort of thing, actually. You know, the punishment killings by the Nazis in the Second World War, when they would surround towns and kill tens or even hundreds of citizens of a town, which they said had been harboring a few partisans or maybe given some partisans some food. This was the same sort of punishment killings, the non-proportionate stuff. This is what the UN really should be dealing with, Patrick, I think. You know, but yes, I think the... the world is slowly waking up to this idea that this is a real powder keg. Look, I mean, just to take a step back from the history of all this, because we have to understand how Israel got there in the first place. It's this kind of crusader state. The First World War was when General Allenby, the British General Allenby, swept the Turks aside with hundreds of thousands of soldiers on both sides died in the campaigns in the First World War to move the Turks, the Ottoman Empire, out of Palestine and up to the north. And then once that had happened, immediately the armistice was signed. Once the battle, I think it was the Battle of Megiddo, the final battle in the First World War in the Middle East to get rid of the Turks, the armistice of World War One was signed. And I remember looking at the timing thinking, well, maybe that was what World War One was really all about. And then, of course, you have a Second World War in Europe, but the Israeli state created in 1948, which was very much Victor Rothschild in London's creation. He managed to get the Soviets on side, which was an incredible thing to do, to vote for the creation of the State of Israel. In their Roland Perry, the Australian writer's book, The Fifth Man, he explains all the background to what Victor Rothschild had been up to in the Second World War and also to do with the creation of the State of Israel. He said he was the number one guy. Obviously, the Balfour Declaration was part of the Rothschild family too. But over in the States, it was Nelson Rockefeller that got the South American votes for Rothschild. So it's the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds helping to get that vote through in 1948. A very important thing was said to the first Prime Minister, Ben Gurion, and that was you can have a vengeance or a state, but not both. This is John Loftus told me this, the special investigator of FBI under Jimmy Carter, of a lot of these Nazi war criminals. And he said that the significance of that was that you could either come after the Nazi war criminals if you wanted, he said to the Zionists, at the creation of the Israeli state, or you can leave them alone and we will deliver the votes for you to have a state. And so that's how it was created. And I think we have to just understand this is a pernicious thing right from the start. There are many, many Jews around the world, certainly friends of mine, that want nothing whatsoever to do with this state the Zionists have created. They're trying desperately to make out that this is, you know, all of Jewry that supports them. Of course, they don't. And this is really just spin. But even more important is this. I think it's disputed. But I think if you're looking at what's been actually happening over the last 100 years or so there, it's this letter of Albert Pike, which was written in the 1880s, which spells out the whole plan for the creation of a fake religious war in the Middle East between the Zionists and the Islamic world. So, you know, the Islamic world is genuinely trying to defend itself against massive provocations from this heretical Judaistic, actually a secular state, which is working with these Masonic plans in mind. The Scottish Rite Freemason Albert Pike's plan to create this massive conflagration in the Middle East. And I think, actually, you know, I first heard about this from some friend of mine who spoke Arabic, who'd been spending 6 months living with the Bedouin. And this is one of the things that they talk about. Yeah, this Albert Pike guy, they've been cooking up a third world war for us in the Middle East for many years. We're aware of this. And so that's why I think the behavior and the military tactics and the disposition of the Islamic world and of the Arab world particularly, I mean, let's forget for a moment about, you know, some of the anti-Israeli Jews and Christians that are living in the area, and also atheists and people of other faiths in the Middle East. You know, they don't seem to get talked about too much, but of course they're caught up in the middle of this. is this in almighty struggle that they're trying, this war, they're trying to get it going. The purpose is literally, that is Naomi Klein's shock doctrine. The bigger the war, the more money you can make out of it, and the more geopolitical influence you can then bring out of that chaos. And you know, the Scottish Rite, I'm sure you do know, the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry's motto is Ordo ab Chao, order from chaos. They're at chaos merchants. If they can create, the bigger the war they can create, the more chaos they can create, the more they like it, because the more they think that they can control the outcome and use it to their own geopolitical ends. So there's much more to this than I think than we're seeing in the certainly the news coverage in this part of the world, which is looking at these individual attacks, ignoring a lot of the history of the tensions between Iran and Israel, certainly ignoring many of the crimes, the war crimes of the Israeli state over the last 20, 30 years, and particularly the last decade or so, and the statements that the Netanyahu and others have made. And of course, one thing that hardly gets mentioned at all is this hundreds of nuclear weapons that the Israelis possess. They accuse the Iranians of possessing nuclear weapons. They're saying, oh, you're developing these things, we've got to get rid of Iran before they develop. Well, they've actually got an Islamic fatwa out, as I'm sure you know, against nuclear weapons. They believe that they're totally unethical, they're so indiscriminate, and so they've said that they will not build them. Whether there are nuclear weapons were available on the black market in the 1990s is another question. From the former Soviet Union, as the soldiers and hadn't been paid for months and years, some of them, they were, it's alleged by the reporter Roger Cook in his documentary Dirty Bomb, he was offered a SS-20, which is a three, I believe it's got three warheads on it, nuclear missile system for a price, for millions of dollars, to certain millions of dollars to the Russian army at the time. So it is possible that these nuclear weapons have been circulating around on the black market. But the Iranians have publicly said to their own people and to the world, we do not want nuclear weapons. We've got no interest because they're far too indiscriminate. We don't agree and believe in them. And so we don't want them, thank you very much. Yet they're always getting accused of trying to develop nuclear weapons by the Israelis, who themselves never talk about the ones except when they do. And do you remember when the Gaza thing first started back in, I think it was November last year, we had one of the ministers of the Israelis talking about nuking, oh, we could nuke Gaza. Well, hang on, that must mean you've got nuclear weapons if you can nuke Gaza. So they do admit it, but they don't like to, the Americans don't like to hear it. They put their fingers in their ears because they know that this would be violations of all their nuclear treaties. Then the Americans would then have to cut off the financial support for Israel.
None of that applies to Israel as far as Washington is concerned. Anyway, they get a free pass even on the nuclear card, believe it or not, at the moment. Tony Gosling, we're talking about Iran, Israel, what's happening next. We're going to take a quick break here with the network TNT. When we come back, we're going to talk about the nuclear deterrent, the nuclear threshold, and also the reactions of Joe Biden and the British government to these latest round of hostilities. All this and more coming up. Stay right there.
I was such a young age. Everything changed. My name is Chloe. When I was 13, my dad was diagnosed with cancer. When I found out, I just didn't know how to react. I felt like everything was just kind of closing in on me. It just became a routine. Dad's doing chemo. I'd come home from school, wait for mum to finish work, and we'd go straight to the hospital, spend a few hours there, just draw. It was hard to navigate going to school, hundreds of kids, and I was the only one with a dying dad. He was diagnosed in March, and then he died in October. Towards the end, I heard about Canteen. It kind of felt nice to know that they had other people like me. They understood what I was going through, and we didn't even have to chat about cancer. In 2020, I became a youth ambassador, so I can help others the way they helped me. I've done so many things since I was 13. I've graduated high school, university, gotten my license, made a move across the country. Life now is just a whole lot more fun. Please give a gift today to support more young people like me experiencing cancer.
Whatever happened to good? It's a word that gets thrown around a lot, and it's become our automatic answer to so much. Hey, how's things?
Good.
Your mum, your weekend?
Good, good.
Is good even that good anymore?
At the Selbos, we believe good deserves better. Let's reclaim its true meaning. To us, good has always been about making a difference, and good never picks or chooses who it helps. Isn't it time we all remember what good really means?
You're with Patrick Henningsen on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the program. We're still in the first hour of this live broadcast. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. Thank you for rejoining us. Hello to everybody in the TNT chat community. Great to see you guys in there. We see some of the usual suspects coming in there. Great numbers as well. We had at the end of last week getting up over 100 almost during that program. So yeah, I was seeing some migration into our amazing chat community there at TNT during this amazing program, and our amazing guest, of course, on the line, Tony Gosling. And Tony, I'm kind of curious about the reaction, firstly, of the United States, the Joe Biden actually calling to restrain the mad dog, as you've well put it, Netanyahu and this incredible right-wing regime in Tel Aviv. Then we've got the British. They're trying to act like they're shoulder to shoulder with America and Israel, but kind of inconsistent on their policies. I've got a clip here from Lord Cameron, this strange foreign secretary that doesn't sit in the House of Commons. And he was put on the spot about this very issue, on the consistency of the policy of the British position. And he didn't really have a very good answer for it. Let's go ahead and roll this clip. I want to get your reaction after this, Tony.
Yeah, but what about Iran's frustration at part of its sovereign territory being flattened?
Well, I would argue there is a massive degree of difference between what Israel did in Damascus and, as I said, 301 weapons being launched by the state of Iran at the state of Israel. For the first time, a state-on-state attack. 101 ballistic missiles, 36 cruise missiles, 185 drones. That is a degree of difference. Yeah. And I think a reckless and dangerous thing for Iran to have done. And I think the whole world can see all these countries that have somehow wondered, well, you know, what is the true nature of Iran? It's there, okay, in black and white.
What would Britain do if a hostile nation flattened one of our consulates?
Well, we would take, you know, we would take the very strong action.
And Iran would say that that's what they did?
Well, what they did, as I said, was a massive attack.
So they were right to respond, but they overreacted, is that what you're saying?
What I'm saying is that the attack they carried out was on a very large scale, much bigger than people expected.
They had a right to respond.
Well, countries have a right to respond when they feel they've suffered an aggression. Of course they do. But look at the scale of that response. Had those weapons not been shot down, there could have been thousands of casualties, including civilian casualties. I think that's a really important point to take into account.
Is this credible? I mean, is his answer credible, Tony? What do you think?
Well, look, Lord Cameron of Benghazi, the butcher of Libya, the man that's turned that country into such a basket, one of the people anyway, has turned it into such a basket case where you've now got live slave trading on the streets. It used to be the country which had the highest standard of living anywhere in Africa. You know, so this is the man who is the chaos merchant, the destroyer of worlds, pontificating. Obviously, he's totally biased. He just wants to support the Israelis, and that's why he's been put in that job. It would have been very difficult, I think, for James Cleverly, the former foreign secretary, to posture in that fashion. But Cameron's got form, which is why Charles III has employed him to do that job. And I don't think Sunak plays any role whatsoever. This is Charlie doing all this. And the British position is so ridiculous that, you know, I don't know if you noticed over the weekend that the Spanish government sent a very clear message to the British government saying, we're not having your aerobatic RAF display team down here in Gibraltar, thank you very much. You're not overflying any of the Spanish airspace with them. We don't trust you. We don't like you. We think you're involved in this genocide that's going on in Gaza. They didn't. This is me paraphrasing. These are very clear diplomatic messages that the Spanish have sent to London, that Madrid has sent to London, over the British support for the genocide. And this is people like Cameron, who are making these idiotic statements about, oh, I don't think we would really respond if, you know, if the British consulate, say, in Iran or Damascus was attacked, say, by the Israelis and several British generals were killed and another five staff, making seven altogether, which is what happened in Damascus. Of course, there would be a massive response by the Brits, but he just can't admit to that because he's a kind of gang merchant person. He's the sort of person that works with his little clique of mates to do what they're trying to do, which is to start a third world war, no less. That's what I think that they're actually up to. As I said before, you know, they think they can make a lot of capital out of this. They can make some big geopolitical changes. But also, the Spanish also said to the Brits that they're not allowed to bring their HMS Queen Elizabeth aircraft carrier in either. So there are European countries and countries all around the world are now seeing not only Israel as a disgusting pariah state, but the Brits too. And I'm glad the foolishness and the recklessness is having its effect. But look, there's also the other thing, which is one of the things you messaged me about, which was what should happen at the UN Security Council. Well, Craig Murray's made it very clear, and I totally agree with him, that we need to see some action, actually, fingers out, folks, from the Chinese and the Russians at the UN Security Council. And of course, the Americans will veto this for a while. But who knows? A UN military force in Gaza to protect the Palestinians, I think, is what's absolutely necessary. And they're going to have to start confronting this genocide and doing something about it. Obviously, that first thing that force would do would be to allow the aid in and to stop the Israelis massacring and murdering people who are collecting aid, but then also potentially to put a no-fly zone over that part of the territory, because otherwise international law is breaking down. It's going to break down. So I think that's a really important sort of positive move that there could be, to have an armed peacekeeping force led by the Chinese at the UN and the Russians at the UN to make sure that this genocide is brought to an end, Patrick. I don't know if what you think, but the UN Security Council has got to be doing something positive and useful here. It's got to show that it's got a bit of teeth. I was watching the Cold Case Hammarskjöld documentary a few days ago on BBC4 here in the UK, which talks about the assassination by, it looks like, the CIA and MI6 and the Belgian mining companies of the UN Secretary General back in 1961, who was trying to help African countries after they'd got their independence to resist the neo-colonial activities of the British intelligence, still trying to claim all the territories over there and particularly mining rights. And so the UN needs to really, I think, assert itself and make sure that there's some sort of peacekeeping force sent into Gaza before any more thousands of innocent people die there, to help get the aid through, if nothing else, to get the aid through the borders.
Yeah, through the Rafah border crossing, not building a jetty, not the U.S. military building a big theatrical a floating pier to bring in the aid by ship and then do all the public relations and all the glorious CNN sound bites and videos about how wonderful and humanitarian the U.S. military is saving the poor people of Gaza. So I think you're right, Tony. First order of business from the U.N. Security Council has to be a de-escalation. And once that's established, then how do we get the aid through to pre-October 7th levels into Gaza ASAP, immediately, without delay? And I think this goes back to the U.S. the fact that the U.S. is restraining Israel, even if it's delaying Israel, it really shows you the nature of the reality of Israel, that it can't really do anything without its big brother with the big stick standing behind it. It's the one supplying all of the military kit, all the reconnaissance, all the ammunition, the bombs. Israel is nothing but a paper tiger without the United States giving it its full-throated backing. And when the U.S. believes that Israel is a political liability or threatening their position internationally with their allies or other people, other countries, you know how quickly that phone call happens and Israel can be brought to heel. I think that's one of the important lessons that was shown here, Tony, is that Israel can be restrained if there's a political will to do it. Your final thoughts, 1 minute left. Go ahead, Tony.
Well, I just like to round up by saying that I honestly believe that almost by doing nothing is the best policy with the Israelis, because they have been hemorrhaging support, as I said, with the Spanish turning on the Brits, saying, no, you're not using our airspace, you're not using our waters, thank you very much, go away, take the Royal Navy away, take the Royal Air Force away from here. All those that have been supporting the Israelis have been coming across these sorts of reactions. But ultimately, we need to work for peace there. And the only way to do that is, I'm afraid, the United States has been invading countries left, right and center, rather like the Nazis were in the late 1930s. And so somebody has got to draw a line somewhere. It's good to see the Iranians have done that, but without any loss of life. No loss of life on Saturday morning. What they've done is they've just taken out their military capability, and that's a wonderful piece of military action.
Tony Gosling, investigative journalist, historian, radio host, author. Thank you for joining us on TNT this week. There he goes, ladies and gentlemen. Excellent segment by Tony Gosling. We're going to take a break here. Top of the hour news headlines coming up. And on the other side, we're going to connect another author and pundit. Jay Dyer is going to join us in the second hour to talk about the end times, eschatology in Israel, Christian Zionism.